What are we to do when we experience loss? Hello, welcome to Good Word. I am Dave Thomas, your host, sitting with two conversation partners, Jen Ogden, who is the family life pastor at the University Church here in Walla Walla, and Brant Berglund, a colleague from the School of Theology. Colleagues, the sad story of human life on planet Earth is that sooner or later we're going to experience loss. Loss of some kind. Mm-hmm. And loss can be very debilitating and very difficult to endure. And so we're invited to talk about that. And maybe we could start by thinking about Adam and Eve, who were the first humans to experience loss. When you think about that, what comes to mind?
From the very beginning, it seems that their first loss was a sense of trust. And I think in your study guide, you've brought out this idea, but they lost trust, first of all, in God's words when they heard the serpent suggesting something else. But then they lost maybe even more trust when the serpent said, your eyes will be opened and you'll be like God. And it says in the text, after they ate the fruit, their eyes were opened and they knew they were naked. So they've been let down on multiple fronts.
Lost their innocence.
They lost their innocence, and they also lost their sense of wonderful vulnerability that then turns into shame.
They lost their garden home. They lost the ability to talk face to face with God.
They end up losing their firstborn son, or their secondborn son, at the hands of their firstborn son.
Correct.
So.
And you know, the sad story of human beings is that in one way or another, all of our life experiences mirror that to some extent. You know, I once heard life described as a journey through loss, that when you are a young child, you have enormous possibilities ahead of you, only some of which will be realized. When you're 95 and on your deathbed, all of that is lost. You are down to no options anymore. And so a cynical view of life is that it's a successful navigation through a minefield of loss. You know, which, as I said, it's a cynical one there. But some types of losses, what about the loss of health?
That could be debilitating because along with it goes a loss oftentimes of dreams, depending on how drastic. But loss of health in a short term is inconvenient. A loss, for instance, a diagnosis of cancer that's terminal brings the end of relationships. It can mean the disassociation of family groups, the loss of finances and home and all the things that you've ever built up in the world. Health can be a major loss. And psychologically, what if you're in an accident and lose a limb? You're grieving that member of your body.
I have an acquaintance from years ago who actually had a contract to play for a major league baseball team as a pitcher. And before he was signed to go to spring training, he had a contract already that he was involved in a farm accident and lost his leg from the knee down, which meant he never played for them. And I watched him all the way through probably his 50s. Never reconciled to that loss. That dream was so big in his mind, and the loss of it was so big that there were times when he just couldn't handle it.
That's tough.
Yeah, kind of sad. What about the loss of trust? Let's talk about that one.
I think it's so sad when it does happen. And I think sometimes we're not honest about it, and we almost become vengeful when we lose trust in someone and we want to get back at them. Not that it would regain the trust, but I think there becomes this weird cycle of mistrust, tit for tat kind of thing. And I think we need to learn to acknowledge the grief that comes from loss first and foremost, rather than reacting to it without acknowledgement. Because sometimes when we just sit in the grief, we can see a way forward. And I think God gives us the wisdom to do that. And so I think sometimes we're just trying to get past the grief and the pain so quickly that we rush through the emotional process and we don't do it well. And then I don't think we can heal from it and move to the next level of healthy function, healthy interaction, all of those sorts of things. So I think being able to sit with loss is sad. I love the beauty of the Jewish idea of sitting Shiva. You know, when someone dies, you go to their home and you sit with them. You don't have to talk. You don't have to bring anything. You just show up. And I think sometimes we need to just show up and face our hurt. And we need to allow other people in our life to do that too.
Yeah, I was thinking about what happens when people break trust by telling lies.
Pet peeve? Oh, yeah. I don't love dishonesty.
No, but what happens when somebody lies to you, though?
It's not pretty.
No, because at what point do you regain trust?
I struggle with that. It takes me a long time to trust people again once they've lied to me.
Yeah, especially if they've done so intentionally. If they told you a lie kind of inadvertently, that's one thing. But when you know somebody deliberately deceived you, how does a relationship continue?
Well, this is a challenge because I find myself in general life to be somewhat suspicious as a person. I'm not easily fooled by things because I kind of always expect that somebody is not going to be honest. But I then, on the other hand, hope for the best and then I get disappointed. And so I'm kind of caught in this conundrum of I don't trust people, but I still want to trust them so much because I know that's the best way to have relationships.
Yeah, I mean, how do you fix broken trust? I've known friends who were lied to within marital relationships that wreaked havoc.
Yeah.
You know, and even though an apology was made, there's still this lingering concern. Okay, you told me a lie once and you did it on purpose to lead me down a path that you thought would keep you out of trouble. And now I find out that there was a deliberate lie. How do I trust you again?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and see, the first time a person tells you a lie is when that happens. If they keep lying to you, you adjust to the reality and say, okay, well, I can't believe that person. But, wow.
I think rebuilding trust, the first and foremost, is for the person who has been the one who's broken the trust to acknowledge that break in the trust.
Yeah.
And I think that takes a level of vulnerability that we are not good at innately. And I think it takes a deep honesty with yourself that I did this. And I'm going to work to be honest from this point on. And I'm going to acknowledge when I mess up and I'm going to be honest about that. And I think building trust has to come from the person who has done the harm, acknowledging the harm done.
But then I worry sometimes that perhaps, you know, you hear about the alcoholic's tendency to be called on to their actions and they confess, they repent, and they say, I'll never do it again. And then they do it again. And then they come back, I'm so sorry, I see what I did, and they repent and they confess. And at some point, you know, we run up against Jesus' words. How often should I forgive my brother when he sins against me? Seven times? That sounds like a lot. No. 70 times 7, it's like, oh, but what about my trust?
Yeah, see, I see that as a little bit different thing because there's an addiction involved.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I wonder about, and Jen, I want to add something to you. What you said is that it seems not only should there be a recognition of the fact that you have betrayed trust, I think there needs to be overt action to make sure that any possibility of distrust is defused. So if I had lied to you, then I think in any occasion where I think you might be wondering about X, Y, Z, I would go out of my way to initiate conversation to say, it's not this and it's not that, I'm not doing this. So
Right. The
person knows that you are intentionally focusing on trying to rebuild trust and not waiting to be quizzed about.
And there are areas of hurt that you're familiar with that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe being sensitive also so you don't put yourself in a position where they will be uncomfortable again.
Yeah.
And saying, I recognize that this is a similar situation to last time. I just want you to know that I'm going to make sure and protect
or that
your trust.
I'm not going to be home yet because of this. I'm calling you now so you know that I'm not off to the barroom or off with my old flame or something.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That I am late, but I am actually at work and I'll be home. And you check in with the person before they have the opportunity to be suspicious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
Let's talk for a few minutes about the loss of freedom, especially as it comes from addictions. Any comments about that?
Well, if you look at the Old Testament and, you know, you just read the Proverbs wisdom literature alone on alcohol, and it says, you know, wine is a mocker and a brawler, and the person who is ensnared by it isn't wise.
Yeah.
There's certainly warning that it leads down a path that ends up a very broken one.
Mm-hmm.
It does, the Proverbs also admit there's a time and a place for it. And, you know, it says, give it to those who are perishing and to those who are hurting and experiencing great loss so that they may forget.
Mm-hmm.
But we do that with opiates when people are injured
morphine.
Or something. Morphine, sure. And we have our controlled ways to deal with that. But in general, boy, if you have somebody who has an addiction, and the newest addictions these days are, of course, computer gaming for young men and young women, and computer pornography addiction, addictions to work are common. These things all have the same effect. They ruin relationships.
Yeah. Yeah.
They destroy them because they control a life.
Yeah, I remember when pornography first began to be available on the internet, and I was in a personal capacity, then I began to have women coming to my office to say, look, we just discovered on our computer at home all these images, and yeah, we are stunned because we never thought my husband would do that kind of thing. And, yeah, you know, the availability of that was what's driving this new eventuality. And I think that you guys would agree with me that very few people can break addictions without outside interference or outside involvement. I mean, you have to be honest and say to somebody, I'm in a mess. Would you help me be accountable? Yeah. If you don't have that dynamic, the odds of change are almost nil.
Well, the problem with most addictions is they're such that it's difficult to recognize you have it while you're in it. If we could recognize it and state the fact, we would probably want to change far more quickly. But we usually think if we have an addiction to something, I'm actually in control, and we deceive ourselves.
Yeah, yeah. And the secretive nature of most addictions is really where their power comes from. Once they become known, like an affair, I understand, is very exciting until it gets known, and then it's hell on wheels.
Right.
Mm. You know.
Yep.
What was I going to say? There's one more loss I want to talk about. What about the loss that comes through death? And I think that as individuals, when we face death, we face the possibility of loss ourselves. But what about the loss of a spouse or a child? Any comments about that loss?
And we've seen a number of families in our church congregation go through both of those. And I think that the families who pull together and hold on to each other in those times and say, I'm going to be intentional about sticking with you, about being here, about showing up, about eating with you, about grieving with you, about crying with you. Those are the families that are likely to come out the other end of grief on a healed path. Yeah. The ones who turn it into a cat fight and start blaming and who disassociate from each other, they don't make it in a healthy way.
Yeah.
And I think death changes everything.
Yeah.
No matter if it's a child or a parent or a spouse, it changes everything. And I think sometimes we expect it to go back to what it was, and it will always be a new normal.
Yeah.
It will always be a different sort of situation. And I think it's okay to acknowledge that. But sometimes we rush in through the grieving process of death, and then we're not able to heal, and we can't get back to a healthy norm.
And we don't let those in our family grieve their own way and help them through it as well. I hear the statistic of a husband and wife who lose a child when they're young-ish, the chances of that couple staying married is very, very low.
You know, I remember years ago a woman, I buried both of her sons. They were in their 50s. One died of a heart attack and one died of cancer. And after that second funeral, this older woman, she looked me in the face. She was a very dear soul. She looked me in the face and she said, Pastor, no mother should have to bury her children.
That's right.
Yep.
And, you know, I think that there's an opportunity for us to come close to people who grieve. And I like what you said earlier, Jen, that just showing up, caring for people, saying, I'm not going anywhere, I'm going to be right here, and you don't have to say anything. We can cry, we can sing, but we're going to be here. So anyway, thanks very much. Our time is gone here. My thanks to you, Brent and Jen, for your contribution. My thanks also to Brad Williams, our engineer, for the good word. I'm Dave Thomas.